Good morning, everyone. I'm Peter Gettler. It's my honor and privilege to be president and CEO of the Cato Institute. Welcome to our Focus on Fiscal Leadership, the launch event for Cato's 2020 Fiscal Report Card on America's Governors. We'll be taking questions online from social media, so please engage with us using the hashtag CatoEcon, CatoEcon. As you all know, Cato's work encompasses the full range of policy issues. From protecting civil liberties to defending the Constitution, making the case for restraint in the use of our military, to less government intervention in our lives and our economy. Fiscal issues, of course, will always have a prominent place in our work, as our voice for spending restraint and fiscal responsibility becomes more important, and I have to say a bit lonelier as the years go by. Well before any of us had ever heard of COVID-19, spending at all levels of American government has been growing on an unsustainable and extremely concerning path. This is an issue of tremendous importance because taxing, and more importantly, spending, represents the burgeoning cost of government all citizens are being forced to bear. And hence, it represents an important, while only partial, measure of the liberty and freedom that we're losing to the growth of government. Runaway government spending may also be the moral issue of our time. For as the political class increasingly abandons the rhetoric, let alone the action of fiscal responsibility, we're at grave risk of putting the economic well-being of future generations at risk. Thus, flirting with fiscal bankruptcy is indeed morally bankrupt as well, since we, the most well-off generation in the history of the planet, may be jeopardizing the ability of future generations to realize their version of the American dream. As a general matter, state governments do a better job than the federal government in managing their finances, since there are many checks by both law and financial markets that help limit the profligacy and fiscal irresponsibility that can be practiced by our states. But within this generalization, the records of our states and the nation's governors vary widely on spending, taxes, and overall fiscal rectitude. So for three decades, every 2 years, Cato has issued its fiscal policy report card on the nation's governors. And as you all know, the 2020 report is launched this morning. For years, under the leadership of Cato's Director of Tax Policy Studies, Chris Edwards, the report card objectively scores governors on the basis of 7 tax and spending variables, calculating a numerical score and assigning an A to F letter grade to each governor. Thus, the methodology considers only facts and numbers, not politics, in ranking the governors and states on the basis of their fiscal policies. Governors receiving an A are those who have cut spending and taxes the most, whereas governors receiving an F have increased spending and taxes the most. In a better world, the report would award 50 A grades every year and eventually put itself out of business. But alas, governors making that grade are relatively few and far between. This year's report has awarded 7 Fs and 14 Ds, but sadly, only 4 As. We're grateful to have one of those only 4 governors receiving an A in 2020 here with us this morning, Governor Christopher Sununu of New Hampshire. In fact, Governor Sununu received the highest numerical score of any governor in the report. He also improved upon the B grade he received 2 years ago, although we'll have to ask Chris Edwards whether the governor earned only partial credit for that B grade, since the 2018 report didn't encompass a full 2-year term for Governor Sununu. He began serving his first term as governor of New Hampshire in January 2017. We'll also have to ask Chris Sununu if the sting of that B grade spurred him to pursue the tax and spending policies that would ensure he notched an A in 2020. I should actually point out that the report awarded only 9 Bs this year, so that's a really good grade nonetheless. But we congratulate and applaud Governor Sununu for earning the highest grade and highest score of any American governor in the 2020 edition. We're delighted to have Governor Sununu with us this morning. New Hampshire is a small state, but it's an important symbol of good government and sound fiscal management. Moreover, Governor Sununu's record shows that fiscally responsible policies can attract broad public popularity and support. Other states should look to the New Hampshire model and to Governor Sununu's outstanding example of fiscal leadership. Chris Edwards will be providing an overview of this year's report card, followed by a Q&A session with the governor. But first, we're going to hear from Governor Sununu, one of, as I said, our few A students. Governor Sununu, once again, congratulations, and take it away.
Well, thank you very much. I can't tell you what it means. It's really incredible. Honestly, it's something that you hear about for a lot of years, and and to receive this recognition is great, because it's, as you know, it's a numerical number, data-driven recognition. I'm a very much a data-driven individual. In my previous three or four lives, I was an engineer coming out of MIT, and then in a ski resort, I ran my own business for a long time. And you know, something we always talk about is there's always a concept of you have to run the government like a business. You really can't do that, because in a business, it's our money, right? We can write a check and we can make investments directly, but in the government, it is the people's money. And so you do need that inherent checks and balances. But the key point is bringing some of those business philosophies, business ideals and practices into the public sector to hopefully spur the change, inspire folks to think a little differently, think a little bit out of the box. And it all starts with good management, of course. You got to build a good team around you. You have to allow those ideas to come onto the table, ideas that maybe in previous administrations were thwarted, seen as politically dangerous. Put everything on the table, do it in a very transparent way, and allow it to allow folks to understand the pushes and pulls and the data behind that. I'm a big believer in the economy. A strong economy creates opportunity for the public sector. So we've been very forceful about, again, trying everything we can to cut taxes, deregulation, all those things that allow businesses to thrive. What do they need? And then get out of their way. The best thing the government can do is get out of people's way. And putting individuals and businesses first is one of those philosophies we try to bring to the table. Kind of like in business, it's customer service, right? So how do we service the customer, not how do we penalize the customer? You know, one thing I noticed when I first became governor is you'd see governors in really good times, they would say, well, times are good. Businesses and people, they have profits, they have some extra money, so it's okay to tax them a little more. But then when times were bad, they would say, well, times are really bad. The government has shortfalls in revenue, so we have to tax you a little more. It was like this never-ending cycle. One way or another, the government always has an excuse for sticking it to you. That was kind of the pattern for many, many years. And that's kind of the cycle that we're trying to break. And when you can lead by example, and again, not just do it from a policy standpoint, but to get the outcomes that we've received and that we have an incredibly strong economy here. Even through the COVID crisis, we had, 2.4% unemployment, I think the day before we had our first COVID number back in February. And then obviously we had to make some tough decisions. Unemployment spiked to about 17%, but because we put those businesses first, we've taken the right proper steps, kept our COVID numbers low, but gradually opened up with stakeholder input, not the government telling you what to do, but allowing the stakeholders to have a lot of that input, would have been able to open things up. And now we're back down to about 4.5% unemployment. It's shocking that we're getting excited about 4.5% unemployment, but we really are on a very strong track. So it's just about putting others first as opposed to big government. And then finally, when the economy does well and you have more money in the till, you don't spend it on more government. You give it back. You give it back to the cities and towns. You give it back to the individuals. Now, we don't have an income tax here, and I vetoed that bill twice, and I'll veto it till the day is long if they ever try to keep putting that on my desk. But our tax base on the state level is built on business taxes. And so you send that back to cities and towns and back to those to offset some of the property tax expenditures that do hit folks. So while I can't, as governor, force a town to cut their property taxes, constitutionally we can't do that, I can send them cash. And when we have the extra money, that's where it's going to go. It's going to go right back for those long-term investments, right? One-time money for one-time investments, whether it be infrastructure or just sending it back for those cities and towns to offset their taxes. So we're just trying to bring some of that type of common sense. I mean, it goes obviously a lot beyond that. Getting an A from Cato is huge. And I'm not going to lie to you. The first person I'm going to call is my father to show him I can get A's. They were a little hard to come by at MIT back in the day, but it's an incredible honor for such a reputable and worldwide renowned organization to recognize the fruits of your labor. I guess as a public servant, you figure, well, with all the criticism and accolades, it's all political anyways. And you kind of just throw that noise aside. But this is an organization that just means so much to so many folks. People do see it as a truly independent, if I may, smart organization that looks at data and actually holds people to accountability and results. And for that, I cannot thank you guys enough.
Well, thank you very much for those comments, Governor. And thanks again for receiving the highest grade in our report. As Peter noted, your polling shows you are one of the most popular governors in the nation. And, you know, while the federal level, both parties seem to have thrown aside fiscal conservatism, it is really good to know that conservative budgeting still gains widespread popular support, at least in some states. So that's really good news. I'm going to give a quick 4-minute overview of the Cato report. Then the governor and I will discuss some of New Hampshire's fiscal policies. Cato has been doing the governor's report since 1992. Governors who have restrained taxes and spending the most receive the highest grades. The report does reflect Cato's preference for smaller government, but it's absolutely a nonpartisan and based on hard data. This year, Governor Sununu received the highest score. New Hampshire spending has been restrained in recent years, and the governor has opposed numerous tax increases. There were three other A's on our report. Governor Kim Reynolds of Iowa signed into law a major tax reform that cut income tax rates. Governor Pete Ricketts of Nebraska has restrained spending and passed income tax reforms. And Governor Mark Gordon of Wyoming has overseen spending cuts, and he's resisted imposition of income taxation in his state. State governments are facing big challenges during this recession, but it's also true that this is after many years of economic growth. Average state spending over the last decade has increased at a 4.1% annual average rate. Now, the responsible states have saved money. They've put money aside in their rainy day funds. For example, California, to its credit, got burned in the recession a decade ago and has built up a very large rainy day fund this time around. But some states did not learn the lesson from the last recession. Illinois went into this recession with absolutely nothing in its rainy day fund. Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker was one of seven governors who received an F on the Cato report card. Despite the recession, Governor Pritzker is increasing 2021 spending substantially, partly based on borrowed money, and that makes no sense. The other F governors this year were Northam of Virginia, Cuomo of New York, Whitmer of Michigan, Murphy of New Jersey, Brown of Oregon, and Inslee of Washington State. Inslee was the lowest scoring governor this year. He entered office in 2013. And since then, general fund spending has increased at an annual average rate of 6.9%. Now, compounded over 7 years, that is a large expansion in government. When Inslee originally ran for the governor's office, he promised not to raise taxes. But since then, he's proposed or enacted an endless stream of tax increases: energy taxes, capital gains taxes, real estate taxes, gross receipts taxes, sales taxes. In 2019, Inslee approved a new payroll tax on all workers in Washington state to raise about $1 billion a year. Governor Inslee has also long pushed to impose a new carbon tax, but Washington voters have rejected a carbon tax by overwhelming majorities at the ballot box twice in 2016 and 2018. So my point here is that there is a large gap between the fiscal restraint of the A governors, such as Governor Sununu, and the F governors on the Cato report who've pursued expansionary policies like Jay Inslee. So the Cato report discusses the main tax and spending actions by each governor. It also discusses some topical issues in state finances, such as rainy day funds and marijuana tax revenues. So now let's turn our attention to New Hampshire. New Hampshire's finances are unique and fascinating, as we're going to explore today. So again, thank you for joining us today, Governor Sununu. And I've got some questions lined up for you here about New Hampshire finances. So that, you know, my first question regards the overall tax burden. New Hampshire residents pay much lower taxes than their neighbors. Measured as a percent of income, state local taxes in New Hampshire are 14% lower than Massachusetts, 27% lower than Maine, and 28% lower than Vermont. Now, some folks might think, well, maybe New Hampshire provides, you know, worse services than the neighboring states. But I noticed that U.S. News and World Report scored New Hampshire schools, K-12 schools, as the third best in the nation. So what is New Hampshire doing right here? Do you simply have more efficient government than your neighbors?
I think efficiency plays a big part of it, right? When you have an efficient government, you can put the resources where they need to go. This doesn't mean people shouldn't confuse efficient government with just massive cuts across the board and all that sort of thing. Efficient government is saying, look, here are our priorities. Here are areas where we can be smarter about the spend. Here's the redundancy, getting rid of a lot of regulations. And actually, we've gone through and looked at virtually every program in the state. And then we compared them both quantitatively and qualitatively to the redundancy factor. There are so many programs, for example, in most states where the Department of Education and the Department of Health and Human Services have massive overlap because a lot of programs and services for children come through the schools, but they're usually health and human services based. So when you go through, we found that something as simple as bringing those two departments together, right? When the left hand and the right hand know what they're doing, it wasn't like we were forcing the state employees to do something they didn't want to do. They loved the idea of coming together, creating a better system. When you empower the bureaucracy of your government, it's amazing what they'll step up and do. They want to be part of better solutions. They really do. And so at the end of the day, by making them part of that, the whole system got much more efficient. And again, like I said, when we started, you focus on the economy, that creates a lot of opportunity at the state. And then you take all that extra money and you send it right back down. You create opportunities for those businesses, those individuals, mostly at the property tax level, where the majority, if you look at a percent, the majority of our taxes are paid at the property tax level. Comparing yourself, I got to be honest, it's great to be, you know, have a tax burden that is much less than Massachusetts and Vermont and New York and Connecticut and Rhode Island and Maine, but that ain't hard. Let's be honest. Those states are going the absolute opposite direction. And so that's why you see so many businesses and families flooding into New Hampshire. You know, one thing I say during this pandemic, people have always had a decision, right? That's the 21st century. You have a decision whether your family wants to stay in a certain area, you want to keep your business in a certain area, whatever it might be. 2020 is forcing people to make that decision. That choice is becoming a decision. And they're actually moving and actually picking up roots and saying, well, I can do better. And doing better is going to the place where we're going to empower individuals with an efficient government. And so, again, it's a model that works. Part of my last 2 years with the Democrat legislature, I don't mean to get political, but is really, again, vetoing the income taxes, vetoing the regulations, vetoing that kind of nationalized playbook that doesn't work. We're very different in New Hampshire. We're very proud of it.
Yeah, and building on that, if you look at, we have very good interstate migration data that the IRS publishes, and New Hampshire really does stand out in the Northeast. New York, Connecticut, Massachusetts, Rhode Island, Vermont all have consistent out-migration from their states, whereas New Hampshire enjoys net in-migration. So you've touched on some issues. Are there other policy advantages that you think New Hampshire has? I mean, why do people move into New Hampshire, but they're moving out of your neighbors?
So first and foremost, there's a quality of life issue here, right? The idea that we can have very high wages, very low unemployment. So everyone who wants a job effectively is going to have a job. You have a great quality of life with experiencing the outdoors and the rivers and the mountains and the lakes and all of that, a good life balance, but you can still be very much connected to a place like Boston. If you want to be part of that urban center, and Boston's a wonderful place. I love Boston. I love New York. But if you don't want to actually live there and have the taxes and the traffic and the bureaucracy, you can literally be 30 miles away in the tax-free suburb of New Hampshire, right? That's effectively what we are. We're the tax-free suburb of Boston. So when you add all those pieces together, you just get to this point where people are realizing they're making that decision. I was on CNBC about a month or two ago, and I was pretty blunt when I said it was almost like somebody went to the Brooklyn Bridge and hung a sign that said, last one out, turn out the lights. Because everyone was just saying enough of this New York nonsense with the riots and the COVID. And you can't even, you know, park your car for less than $50 in New York. You can't drive in without them hitting you for something. And then they tell you, well, times are tough. So we need more money. The government should not be the priority, right? The people and the businesses, they have to be the priority. It drives me crazy when I hear other governments say, we need. They keep using that word need. I do not think that word means what you think it means, but government seems to get away with it all too often. But it's about, again, just making sure we're having a bit of a change in philosophy, empower the efficiencies and empower those to bring those efficiencies with accountability. It's management 101.
That's right. And, you know, families, of course, need, money themselves for their own priorities. So you've touched on something here there's a broader freedom issue here. Cato publishes an annual Freedom in the 50 States report, which assesses not only economic freedoms, but civil liberties as well. And New Hampshire usually ranks first or second top in the country on that scale. But, dramatically, Vermont is ranked 46th. And Maine is ranked 39. So New Hampshire not only has more economic freedom, but more general freedom than the nearby states. So, is there something in the water sort of in New Hampshire, or is it the structure of government in New Hampshire that you think keeps government limited? What do you think the answer is?
So for those who don't know, our structure of government is very, very different. First and foremost, The citizens have all the say. We have the largest legislative body in the country next to the U.S. Congress. We have 400 members of our House of Representatives. They all get paid $100 each, which means they got to really want to be there. And they're really serving their communities at a micro level. And so the citizens have a direct voice, because if you don't know the cell number of your local representative, well, you just haven't asked, right? So everyone can have direct connection with somebody that is going to create policy that directly impacts their life. Because most of our taxes are local in the property tax base, we still have town meeting. It's not some old tradition. It is an incredibly powerful tool for citizens to have. They can walk into their town meeting in March once a year and have a direct say on their budget, which is the vast majority of their taxes. So they have a direct say what's happening in their schools. School contracts are done, again, at the local level, local control. Very, very important tool. And then you, at the state level, you just have such a representative body. Then we have this thing called the Executive Council. The Executive Council is a 5-member group elected every 2 years, pure checks and balance on the power of the governor. So no one individual has ultimate power for too long. And then here's the big one. As a citizen, I love it. As a governor, it drives me crazy. Every one of us, all the representatives, all the senators, the Executive Council, the governor, you could fire us every 2 years. Every 2 years, we all have to get reelected. So again, this complete accountability to the process. Some people would think that that puts more politics in, right? Because you're always running for office again. But it's just not like that here. I think folks understand you got to get stuff done. And if you get rid of the politics and get a lot done, then you can spend the 4 to 5, 6 months, whatever it might be, running for office. But it's not like you have to run every, you know, be truly running every 2 years. You have to come up for election, but it's all about getting stuff done. And we tend to be a very purple state, right? 1 year more Republican, 1 year we're more Democrat. And that, again, forces us to really work across the aisles and just and try to achieve goals. Now, when you got to make tough decisions, you got to make tough decisions. I'm the first Republican governor since the Civil War, fully Democrat legislature. In my first term, I had a fully Republican legislature. So I've kind of seen both sides of that coin, both sides of that spectrum. We created a great model in 17 and 18. We had to hold the line and say no to the income taxes and the tax increases and all that sort of stuff in 19 and 20. And then we'll see, you know, where we go in 21 and 22. But hopefully we've at least set a precedent of accountability and standards. And so that, you know, if it's me or someone after, I think it's going to be me. But after this election in 21 and 22, we're just building off the successes that we've had as opposed to trying to reinvent the wheel every 2 years.
Yeah, that's all sounds very true to me. And to drill down a little bit on the structure of government, inform our listeners today, you know, New Hampshire has no general sales tax. It's also got no broad-based personal income tax. It gets most of its state local revenues from property taxes. Now, interestingly, you know, property taxes, according to public polls, are the most disliked type of tax in America. And I know, you know, in New Hampshire, there's been battles over property tax levels and school funding and the like. But it does seem that, you know, one reason why government in New Hampshire remains small is that the main tax is kind of a very visible one that, you know, people can appreciate the cost of government because they see it in their property tax. So there must be sort of a love-hate relationship there. People don't like property taxes, but it is a good, it does represent the cost of government to them.
You've hit it right on the head. I've always said when it comes to, let's say, federal taxes, right, the federal income tax you have to pay, I think every American should have to write that check. Not that the number should go up or hopefully down, but if you had to actually write that check out of every paycheck every week, you had to feel the pain a little bit, there would be tax reform in this country immediately, right? Because there would be a revolution. People would finally be truly realizing, wait, you're taking this from me. You're forcing me to give something to you instead of this whole, we'll just take it out of your check before you notice it's even gone. Right? Property taxes work like that. You have to write that check. You go down to your town hall. You got to put your money in escrow. You see it, you feel it. And then all of a sudden it's gone and you got to save again for your next property tax bill. And because of that, people stay very invested, because it truly is an investment, with their town and their local officials and their leaders. And they hold them as accountable as anybody. So it is a more painful way to do your taxes, but it really drives much better accountability and ensures that the people not just have a say, but they want to have a say, and they're going to let you know. In New Hampshire, I'll be walking up the cereal aisle in aisle 6 and someone will turn to me and say, hey, governor, boom, and you know, they'll make sure I know where they stand on an issue. And the selectmen and the budget committee get it even worse, because everybody knows their name and everyone knows where they live in a lot of our smaller communities. And so they know they're going to be held to an accountability and a standard. And it's the best checks and balance of government you can have, is the people having the power on any of the local officials.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of the other 49 states could certainly learn a lot here. I mean, and you touched on this too, that, you know, government New Hampshire is very decentralized. Just looking at the tax data here, in New Hampshire, 61% of all state local taxes are local, whereas the U.S. average is 43%. And so it's that decentralization that seems to help limited government, to limit government as well. Let's jump on to energy taxes. What's called the Transportation and Climate Initiative is a project of the states in the Northeast to impose a regional emissions cap, which would raise gasoline prices, and it would be like a regressive gas tax hike. Now, you've said that New Hampshire will not join this emissions tax plan. One issue that I think is important is that, you know, my understanding is this emissions system would work at the wholesale level. So residents wouldn't even know, they would see the gas prices going up. They wouldn't know that the government was responsible for that increase in gas prices. And that goes to what we're talking about visibility. So can you explain your position on this transportation and climate initiative?
Sure, this was a big deal. And we were watching this for about a year, really led by Massachusetts and Charlie, where it was kind of driving the boat with a lot of other states. I think they had something like 13 states that, and we were involved in the discussions. And we kept telling them, if this isn't designed the right way, it's not going to work. And they wouldn't really say exactly what their thought process was. So they allowed us to participate. We could kind of see it from afar. As soon as we saw where this thing was going, I said, we're not gonna partake in this. They didn't seem to care. They came out and made their announcement. It was going to be, I think on day one, something like a 17 cent gas tax to 13 states across the Northeast. And as you just pointed out, it was going to be this hidden thing behind the scenes at a wholesale level. And they said, well, it'll go to investing in urban public transportation, which is a fine idea if you want to invest in that. But really what that means is all these rural states are going to be subsidizing, you know, the debt of Massachusetts and the MBTA and Boston and all of these things. And so while I can appreciate Charlie's thought process, and Governor Baker and I get along great, but we came out, I think, within about 20 minutes of that announcement and said, no way, we're not part of it. And we strongly encourage other states to do the same, to look deep and understand the numbers. Don't be fooled by any of this. It sounds nice politically, transportation, climate initiative, but with deep down, it was going to whack people right in the pockets. And so we led the charge. Sure enough, other states kind of followed our lead. I think other states might still be going forward with it, which is fine. Look, if that's what Massachusetts wants to do, or Maryland or New York, God bless them. That's on them. But you can't come up here and try to basically ask us to subsidize your debt, with a hidden gas tax. It's why we said no to tolls, right? They wanted to increase the toll taxes here in New Hampshire. And I said, we were about a vote away from it until I stepped in and said, absolutely not. Well, it's just a quarter. It's another 25 cents, Governor. It's another 50 cents. Yeah, at the end of the day, that's $400. That's a lot of money to most families, right? So, you know, it's the typical, we've talked about it for years. We've heard about it for years. The government literally nickels and dimes you. They literally say, well, what's a half a percent? What's the big deal? What's a percent here and a half percent there? And before you know it, within 5-10 years, your half a percent income tax becomes 5 or 6%. Government is just spending tons of money. Your systems and programs haven't really gotten any better, but the government has more security. You don't, as a family, you don't as a business, but the government feels more secure. Look, as the head of government, I'm telling you, don't buy into what the government is trying to sell you all the time. You gotta really do the numbers and hopefully have the leadership there that doesn't mind saying, this might not sound politically convenient, but it's the right thing to do.
Yeah, there's a very interesting parallel here too with the whole issue of paid family leave. You've vetoed mandatory paid leave bills in New Hampshire that would have imposed a new statewide wage tax on all workers. You've noted that it would undermine New Hampshire's no income tax advantage. There's an interesting federalism story here too, that some states like Massachusetts have passed mandatory paid leave bills, while other states like New Hampshire and Vermont have rejected a mandatory approach. So Vermont Governor Phil Scott has also vetoed mandatory paid leave bills in his state, as you have. At the same time, there's been, you know, there's a movement federally to impose a top-down paid leave, mandatory paid leave from Washington that would sort of, that would be pushed onto all states. Now, it seems to me that, you know, if New Hampshire and Vermont have have clearly expressed their opposition to a mandatory approach in favor of a voluntary approach. Massachusetts, they want to go the mandatory direction. That is fine. That is diversity. That is the genius of American federalism. And so maybe you can tell us a little bit more about your thinking on paid leave.
Sure. So look, I'm a supporter of paid leave in concept, because here in New Hampshire, we designed a way to do it with the private sector, and it would be a choice, not mandatory. If you want to buy into that insurance package, that's essentially what paid leave is, an insurance package. We did a preliminary run, and we had about 10 to 12 different companies come to us and say, yes, we want to be part of this. We will help manage the system. We know the actuarial tables. We can manage it. And the way we did it is essentially the state would pay as part of our benefits package for just our state employees. We have lots of benefits for them already. For a couple $1 million, we would pay to have paid family leave for our employees. And that massively large pool would drive premiums really, really low that then everybody else could share the benefit of across the state. But then you have the choice as an employer or an employee, the choice of whether you want to buy into that plan or not. The Democrats had a very different plan. I'll say the other side of the aisle, the Democrats, whatever you want to call them today. They said, no, it's mandatory. It's 0.5. The payment shall be 0.5% per wages per employee, but it's not a tax. Payment shall be 0.5 of wages. Sorry, it's a premium on wages. I mean, this crazy political speak, a premium on wages, they try every linguistic piece of gymnastics that they can find. But at the end of the day, it's a tax. And at the end of the day, they can then raise it and do other things with it. And they shouldn't be making the government effectively the insurance company. That's what, when these states that do paid family leave and mandatory, they're effectively hiring hundreds of people to make themselves the insurance company for all of those that have to be mandated into it. The government shouldn't be part of an insurance company like that at the state level. So you bring the private sector in, right? Name almost any insurance company in the country would love to be part of this. And they all clearly wanted to be here. So what we're trying to do is change the model and say there's a way to do it with private sector with a little bit of innovation. These mandatory models have failed throughout the country. They've brought their states to the brink of financial collapse. They always very often have to be additionally subsidized. But if you do a private sector approach, you really can make it work. And I still think, again, my paid family plan with a private sector approach is the successful model. I've talked to the president and the administration about it. I've talked to folks in Congress. I think there's a nationalized model to be there as well. It's all about choice, right? You know, it should never be about the government forcing another buck out of your pocket for something you don't want to buy.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And, you know, let's jump to regulations for a minute or two here, and which ultimately is a fiscal issue because it affects state government costs. You focused on reducing unneeded state local regulations to boost growth in New Hampshire. You know, related issue is the pile of federal regulations that come top down from programs like housing on education and the like. And if there was a national paid leave program, there would be, you know, a problem of federal regulations falling down on the states and raising costs. So what are some of the frustrating federal mandates that New Hampshire deals with, and what can we do about it?
All of them. Really? Look, two words, a block grant. The amount of money that would be saved if they would take some of these massive government programs and just write the check, if you will, to the state government and say, look, we finally are appreciating that New Hampshire and New York and Arizona and California and Michigan are all very different states with different priorities, different demographics, different socioeconomic challenges. And we're going to allow states to make the investments as they best see fit and allow the state's true federalistic ideals of the Constitution come to bear. It's wonderful when the federal government can provide financial support, but the amount of money you would save alone in just a federal bureaucracy, I know the lawyers would probably not like it too much because they'd be out of a job, you know, pretty quick in Washington. But at the end of the day, that's far and away the best way to do it. I can't find a single federal program that I think is better run by Washington, D.C. than the state of New Hampshire. I mean, by definition, other than the military, right? Let's stick with the military. They do a great job there. But other than that, no, it should be at the state level because we can create the efficiencies that the federal government just doesn't have the ability to do. And, you know, a lot of folks, one of my bigger frustrations isn't just with the regulations, and I'm going to be a little harsh here. Republicans and Democrats alike in Washington, they talk a good game, but then they get there and they sit on their hands, right? They're afraid to actually say, we're going to truly dig deep. We're going to truly try to innovate. We're going to whiteboard it. All the businesses out there, they know sometimes you got to get tough and whiteboard a situation and start from scratch. Take some of your losses to get your long-term gains back into play. That's one of the ideals that we think we do very well here. Now, at the state level, when you create efficiency in government, what you effectively do, it could be something as simple as instead of a two-hour application to get, you know, help, some sort of government assistance, it's a 20-minute application. There's accountability. It asks the right questions, but it's simple. What we found is when the government creates a simplified process, it puts pressure on the cities and towns to match us with the simplification, to match us with the lack of bureaucracy, right? Because no city and town wants to be the tougher than the state when it comes to being the gatekeepers, if you will, to better customer service. So it all, like any company or any business, it starts from the top, I think, setting a good example, empowering those and asking other folks within your departments, your divisions, your cities and towns, however you want to look at it, to match you in that quality of service. And so it takes a little time to get there. We got rid of 1,600 rules and regulations within the first few months of being governor. In my first summer, I signed an executive order and wiped them all out. And again, that set a tone for our departments, which later set a tone for our cities and towns. So there's an aspect to just leadership here in showing that and being very transparent about it. Look, not everything we do is going to be perfect, and not every path we take is going to be the ultimate final answer. I'm an engineer. I'm all about designing the best system I can, knowing that you rarely design the perfect system the first time. Government tends to do that. Here's the law, here's the system, we'll leave it and we'll come back in 5 years and take a look at it. Terrible way of doing business. You need to design a system with that flexibility, right? If you create a system with flexibility and own up to say, hey, we tried A, B, and C, A and B worked, but C didn't work so well. That's okay. We're going to pivot our funds and resources from C into over here. We already have another idea there. Be flexible so that ultimately you're just getting the best product at the end of the day. So many folks, especially on the legislative side, want to pass a law, pat themselves on the back and move on. But it really takes the operationalizing and the innovation, if you will, to keep these systems accountable to the results that you want to see.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think block grants on a lot of areas would be a great first step forward. There is no doubt, just casual observation of the way the federal government works and the way state governments work, that once the federal government goes down one path and imposes a certain system on all 50 states, Washington is so rigid, their policymakers don't accept that they need to reform and adjust down the road, where state governments, you know, they're all experiments. Some work, some don't, and they learn, states learn from each other. And this is, you know, I really fear, particularly, I think there's, you know, lots of, you know, new federal ideas about Green New Deals and paid leave laws and the like, which would be top-down impositions. I think it would put the states in a real straitjacket, which would be really unfortunate. So the last question I've got for you today is on rainy day funds. State governments went into this recession a lot more prepared than the recession a decade ago, to their great credit, at least most of them did. Average rainy day funds in the 50 states today are about double before the last recession. So do you think that this was a tough recession for a lot of state and local governments? I mean, do you think that states have kind of learned a valuable lesson here? We never know when a recession is going to come. And so the message, it seems to me, the lesson is that, you know, states should be frugal. They should pay down their debts when they can, and they should build up large rainy day funds ahead of the next recession.
Absolutely. Could not agree more. As far as the rainy day fund, ours is still too small. I can tell you, just in New Hampshire, it's never enough for me. It's really not. I worked in the skiing industry for a while, and we literally needed a rainy day fund, because when it rained, no funds were coming in. And so it really taught you the difference between, again, accounting for on a gap basis, a cash flow basis, seasonality, planning for that rainy day, if you will, literally sometimes. And just being prepared, because at the end of the day, you have a responsibility to the obligations that you've made, especially in the public sector. We've made certain obligations to be there for certain programs that we passed legislatively, to be there for certain citizens that are relying on, whether it's something as simple as the DMV being open or something as complicated as programs that help that are more progressive in terms of abused kids and mental illness and substance use disorder, things of that nature that we're always challenging ourselves with. Those are obligations we have to be there for. And good management can get you there. Some of these states that just borrow themselves out of oblivion, because again, their priority is just covering their back, covering their previous bad decisions. Well, people are leaving those previous bad decisions. California, New York, even Washington, Oregon, these states, that people are running out of these states left and right because finally, unfortunately, the policy is catching up with them. Now, we don't want to see anyone not do well, but that's just a shame. It's really a shame. And so the problem with politics, if you will, is everyone has this massively short memory. In the moment there's a crisis and, you know, for the next couple of years, hopefully the states learn from it. They build up those reserves when they can. But eventually they get lazy. Governments get lazy when not held accountable. And so you got to make sure that there's that feedback response system, whether it's through a better electoral election process or whatever it might be, so that they are kept on their toes and they have to be kept to their word. When they say they're going to cut taxes, you got to at least fight to cut the taxes. Understandably, you might have to fight your legislature and there's a checks and balance there, but at least fight for it. Do what you're going to say. Stand behind those principles. And if the dollars aren't necessarily adding up, make tough decisions. There is always a way to get out of a fiscal crisis without new taxes. That has been proven time and time again. It might be pleasant. It might require some strong leadership and tough decisions, but it's the absolute obligation. That's the number one obligation that we take with us as elected officials. So there's always a better way to do it. Now, we talk a lot as governors. Governors have to innovate. They have to be, for the most part, they're held much more accountable than Congress and Senate. I mean, Congress and the Senate in Washington. Where's the accountability? I mean, let's think about what their job is. Their job is to approve a policy, approve funding, and then they're kind of done. I mean, what else do they do? Congress and Senate doesn't have to innovate or design or implement or create accountability or metrics or standards. They don't have to do any of that. Governors do. And we need to be held accountable to that. And we work together a lot. I think some governors try to play the political angle a lot more than others. But at the end of the day, you know, I'm a big believer that, and I've always said this and I'll say it forever, I think only a governor should ultimately be president, right? Or only a CEO should be president of the United States, because you have to have some management responsibility before taking over the ultimate management job. Congress and Senate really don't have that in their repertoire. So again, accountability is paramount. Holding those politicians accountable, not just today and tomorrow, but for the long term, is really paramount. And getting the citizens engaged, I think, is the best way to do that. That's what our founding fathers created the federalistic system based on that sense of accountability, on local control, and making sure the people had the final say.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. And there's no doubt. I mean, just watching Congress and also state budgeting for many years, that, you know, for federal policymakers, unfortunately, the incentive is just to pass a program and not to worry too much about how it actually works, because it's the spending amount that seems to be important to them. Whereas at the state level, you've got to worry about how programs actually really work, and you make adjustments as you go on. So thanks a lot for coming on today with us, Governor Sununu, and congratulations again on your grade. And thanks for restraining government in New Hampshire. I mean, New Hampshire really is, you know, it's an important symbol in America of good government and sound fiscal management. So we appreciate it very much. And thanks for everyone for watching today and tuning in. The Governor's Report is available at cato.org. Thank you.